For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson. With the latest readout video from our Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to which you should subscribe, along with our YouTube or Rumble channel if you haven't already, and with a question that climate alarmists should answer. If we humans really do control global temperature with our CO2 emissions, what should we set the level to as the ideal, and how do they know? We raise it now particularly because Roger Pilkey Jr. just weighed in on this one, asking, quote, "Was the global climate of 1850 to 1900 really so great?" End quote. And it's a good question, given the obsessive focus on limiting temperature increases since 1850, a year inexplicably labeled pre-industrial times. And given that, as Pilkey Jr. notes, quote, "climate activists claim that every increment of warming over the historical pre-industrial baseline results in more harm to people on the planet," end quote. They do indeed say that, even in tenths of a degree, an imperceptible rise. But would they really prefer that we had the climate of the late 19th century? And again, how would they know? It might seem trivial to complain that the Industrial Revolution had actually been underway for three quarters of a century by 1850, although if people don't know things like that, you might legitimately wonder what else they don't know, including that the entire Holocene before 1850 was pre-industrial, and so was the entire history of the Earth before the Holocene. But it's not trivial, because it's not trivial to ask why we are continually told that the climate of the mid-19th century should be regarded as so ideal that any departure from it, at least upward in temperature, is a calamity to be avoided at all costs. As Pilkey Jr. notes about this habitual alarmist combination of certainty with ignorance, quote, "One important reason that the period 1850 to 1900 serves as a useful baseline of climate utopia is that almost no one has any idea what the climate looked like back then, much less the climate impacts actually experienced," end quote. Oh dear. You mean all this talk of storms getting more severe, floods and droughts ditto, snow disappearing only to fall in massive quantities due to warming and all that stuff is based not just on a misreading of modern conditions, but of total unawareness of a baseline for comparison? Yep. Pilkey Jr. says that he's been reading a book called Late Victorian Holocausts, El Niño, Famines, and the Making of the Third World by a guy named Mike Davis. And that book indicates that, for instance, quote, "more than 50 million people died in the mid-1870s related to extreme weather and climate, about 4% of global population." Today, that same proportion of the world's population would be over 320 million deaths, or almost the entire population of the entire United States. We cannot even imagine this magnitude of human suffering, end quote. Now, try blaming those catastrophes on Henry Ford. And there's more where that came from, such as, quote, "the great Midwest wildfires of 1871, which killed as many as 2,400 people, the 1872 Baltic Sea Flood, an 1875 Midwestern U.S. locust swarm of an estimated 12.5 trillion locusts, the 1878 China typhoon that killed as many as 100,000 people, and the U.S. experienced six landfalling major hurricanes in the 1870s, compared to just three in the 2010s, end quote. So, what little we know about earlier weather suggests that it wasn't better and may have been worse, especially in cold periods. The medieval warm period probably saw nicer and more stable conditions than the cold periods on either side, while the Little Ice Age appears to have been both the coldest period since the last glaciation and exceptionally nasty in terms of weather. On the other hand, the Holocene climatic optimum, which is certainly warmer than today despite all this angry prattle about 2023 being the warmest year in 125,000, saw not disaster and extinction, but the invention of agriculture, pottery, writing, and metallurgy, while the parts of northern Africa that are now desert were then largely lush and fertile. As late as the Roman warm period, that part of Africa was actually the breadbasket of the empire. The Sahara does not often get described that way today, now does it? So, ask your favorite alarmist, with all those periods to choose from, why do you prefer 1850? And what do you think it was like back then? And how do you know? Pilkey Jr. warns that, quote, "a careful look at history tells us that the global average surface temperature is not a control knob that we can set to a preferred value to prevent suffering," end quote. Now, here at CDN, we'd go further and say it's not what we can set to a preferred value at all. But if someone claims otherwise, or even just wishes otherwise, ask them where they would set it and why they would set it there, and how they know it was nicer then. If they can't or won't explain their position, then discount any further climate-related remarks that they might make as willfully ignorant babble. And now, a word from our sponsor. And that's you, our viewers and our readers. Because we're crowdfunded, we're not subsidized by governments, we don't get grants from giant environmental foundations, and we're not getting those oil company checks our critics keep talking about. It's you who sustain our work. So please click here and make a monthly pledge, $5, $10, $20, so that we can keep producing these videos and pushing back against mistaken, even deranged climate orthodoxy. And now, back to me. In the newsletter, we also note The Guardian panicking that, quote, the climate crisis turned the drought that struck the Amazon rainforest in 2023 into a devastating event, a study has found. The drought was the worst recorded in many places and hit the maximum exceptional level on the scientific scale, end quote. Ooh, the scientific scale. Did you know there was one? Or that it has an exceptional level on it? Or that at the tippy-tipping point top of the exceptional end, it says maximum? After which, presumably, the dial snaps off. Well, maybe not, but I'll bet you knew this part. Quote, without planet-warming emissions from the burning of oil, gas, and coal, the drought would have been far less extreme, the analysis found, end quote. Now, the IPCC doesn't agree, but when journalists say that scientists say, mere data is superfluous. In the newsletter, we also make fun of a Wall Street Journal, The Future of Everything feature, asking, quote, are sailboats the future of cargo shipping, end quote? And then giving the short answer, time will tell. But while we are nostalgic for old-time sailing ships, it's hard to believe that the climate is so fragile that its future hinges on whether people put ugly modern sails on big ocean-going freighters. Especially since something called the Daily Digest warns that, quote, if we don't cut emissions by 50% in 7 years, we are doomed, end quote. Yeah, doomed to receive more warnings that we have just a decade or so to act boldly or blah blah snooze. The Manhattan Contrarian, on the other hand, notes the peculiar impulse many politicians have to make their jurisdiction a climate leader, including New York State, which, quote, enacted its Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in 2018, announcing its climate leadership to the world for all to envy, end quote. Unfortunately, it didn't really work because, quote, 5 years into the competition, New York's greenhouse gas emissions have actually increased substantially, end quote. So, at the risk of seeming weird, why not just try to have a policy that works? I suppose it's not vainglorious enough. But speaking of not leading, in Heat Map Daily, Jillian Goodman complains that, quote, the rich drive climate change. The wealthiest 1% of global citizens are responsible for 16% of global emissions, according to a report in The Guardian a couple months ago, end quote. And, to her credit, she then observes pointedly that, quote, the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland wrapped up today, end quote, without progress, because, it was attended by rich people with private jets. Still, the news isn't all bad. USA Today whimpers that, quote, social media is still not doing enough to stop misinformation denying the existence and causes of climate change, end quote. Social media being apparently a concrete bunker devoted to protecting dogma, not millions of places where people argue, natter, yell, blaspheme, or post images of macrame. Also, AP reports that, quote, scientists have mapped the largest coral reef deep in the ocean, stretching hundreds of miles off the US Atlantic coast, end quote, which nobody really knew existed. But they do know, for sure, that climate change will doom whatever coral is, and wherever it is, and whatever it is. Also, under the heading, It Is More Mathiness, you get, quote, AI predicts major ice loss even with immediate climate action, end quote, because apparently a natural warming that has seen glaciers retreat for centuries will probably continue, but will become our fault and evil and accelerate ice loss from 34% to 50%. Unless that 16% difference is just a guess dressed as a computer. We also note a Heat Map Daily piece called, quote, the last gasp of winter sports, snow is all but done, end quote. Which is strange, since the Northern Hemisphere is seeing snow cover well above average this winter, and in North America the trend is actually up in many places. But if the theory and the facts conflict, alarmists have a simple solution. Then they wonder why they're not more trusted. Well, how about The Economist, speaking for Davos person, and conceding that, quote, an influx of Chinese cars is terrifying the West, end quote, but arguing editorially that the West, quote, should keep its markets open to cheap, clean vehicles, end quote. Now, if you believe China is manufacturing car batteries in a clean manner, you probably shouldn't be a journalist. But of course, the fundamental idea is that hollowing out what remains of American and European manufacturing to fund Chinese geopolitical ambitions is fine if, at the same time, it helps wealthy people obey government virtue signaling mandates with less sacrifice. In other news, Donald Trump remains inexplicably popular outside the 1%. We also note that, because reality is tricky, Robinson Mayer at Heatmap Daily instead invites readers, quote, to dream. Envision a future where the U.S. has succeeded in slashing emissions faster than any other country on Earth. What will our policy priorities look like then, end quote? Alleviating the resulting poverty, we're tempted to say. But since it's not going to happen, it doesn't really matter now, does it? In the newsletter, we also continue our ECS in the Real World series by noting this cliche about the 30,000-foot view in order to introduce a study that goes much, much further, getting the 540-million-year view of climate history. And guess what? The ECS revealed in this analysis is 1.7 degrees Celsius, close to the many others we've reported based on modern data, and too low to justify any meaningful climate policy. And we also note the trendy use of emergent constraints to estimate ECS, in which you find something that you think correlates to ECS, measure that, and then call it ECS. But a new study finds that the trendy subtrend of negatively correlating ECS with volcanic cooling just doesn't hold up statistically. Gotta go back to the old-fashioned one where you actually measure things. And finally, from the CO2science.org archive, we bring you a study of how computer climate model projections of marine tropical clouds correspond to actual satellite data. And to nobody's surprise, except those in the cult, the answer is not well at all. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I don't wish 1850 were back and howling outside my window.